and leeches were coming at us, these demonic little black slinkies, head over tail, doggedly coming at us. We'd step back and they'd continue coming at us, wanting to suck our blood. Was I high and paranoid, or was that actually a thing, you know? I'm not sure.
Welcome to Deviate with Rolf Potts. Today I talk with travel guru Rick Steves, whose Asia travel memoir On the Hippie Trail comes out this month. Of course, Rick has made his name as an expert on Europe travel, but the trip he took across Asia in 1978, recounted in this new book, is what inspired him to make the transition from being a young piano teacher to being a young travel writer. The hippie trail travel era of the 1960s and 1970s gave rise to a lot of travel writing icons. People like Tony and Maureen Wheeler, who co-founded the Lonely Planet Travel Guidebook Company, or Ed Buren or Kevin Kelly, who've talked about Europe and Asia travel on this podcast before. The hippie trail was also something of an inspiration to people like me, who got their start as Asia travelers in the 1990s. It occurs to me that there isn't really a name for the early dial-up internet era of travel in the late 1990s where I got my start, and maybe somebody needs to come up with a name. But regardless of when you get started traveling across a place like Asia and what people call the travel trail you follow, there's something universal about these life-changing travel experiences, and that's what Rick and I talk about in this episode. We talk about what it was like to take pictures of your experiences when you could only afford to take 10 or so film photos each day. We talk about what you had to do when you got separated from your travel partners back in the day before the internet and smartphones. We talk about what it was like to travel before there were many guidebooks to most parts of the world. And we talk about what it was like for Rick to smoke hash and pot for the first time during his journey across Asia. Rick and I also compare notes on being raised Lutheran and how travel expands your idea of who your neighbor is and what wealth is. We start by talking about how I first discovered Rick's work through a book called Asia Through the Back Door, and how I might be the only person who knew him as an Asia travel expert before I realized he was best known as a Europe expert. Let's listen in. So, Rick, I was reading your new book, The Hippie Trail, and something seemed faintly familiar about it. And so I went on Amazon and I bought a copy of this, Asia Through the Back Door. And I realized that I might be one of the few Rick Steves fans who at some point thought, oh, Rick Steves writes about Europe too? Because my entree into Rick Steves was Asia Through the Back Door, which in retrospect sort of influenced my thinking that went into my first big Asia trip, which in turn influenced my book Vagabonding, which people still want to talk to me about. So right. It was really fun to sort of see your first adventure into Asia, and I'm looking forward to talking about that right now.
All right. Well, that's great. And I think you're the only person I've ever met who has that book, Rick Steves' Asia Through the Back Door. That's before I decided to just focus on Europe. And it's an indication that I love traveling in Asia.
Yeah. It's funny how books work when you're young. I didn't even own a copy, Rick, in the 1990s. My roommate in Korea had one. Oh, yeah. And I was going to go for more farther flung parts of Asia. And so I read it and took notes without actually buying a copy. So it wasn't until I bought a used copy on eBay a week or two ago that that I owned my own copy of Asia Through the Back Door. So,
all right.
So let's talk about how Asia came on your radar. I'm curious, was it known as the Hippie Trail during the 70s, or is that a retrospective appellation?
You know, I've always thought of it as the Hippie Trail, and I haven't really thought of it much at all since I did it in 1978 until I rediscovered my journal during COVID. But I always think of it as the Hippie Trail. And since then, I've just kind of found out, I've done a little digging around, and that's what it was called. I mean, there's movies out about the Hippie Trail, and there's books that people have written about that. I think what's interesting about my experience is I did this before I was a travel writer. I was a piano teacher. I had no interest in being a professional travel writer. I didn't write my first book, Europe Through the Back Door, for a couple years after that. And every summer I would just say, my kids don't want to practice the piano. I'm going to go to Europe. I'll see you in the fall. And I ended up doing this trip. And 1970 was actually the last year you could do the Hippie Trail. The subtitle of the book is Istanbul to Kathmandu and the Making of a Travel Writer. That bus ride, that trip, that epic road trip from Istanbul to Kathmandu, it closed down after the Shah fell and Iran became a theocracy under the Ayatollah. And you couldn't do it after the Soviets invaded Afghanistan and the war that started there. And we were doing it just on the eve of both of those big events. Mm. And I happened to be, and I don't know why, but just fanatic about writing this journal. And it was a tradition of mine back then, before I was a travel writer, to buy a hardbound empty book, usually 200 pages, and fill it with beautiful penmanship, fill every page with intimate descriptions of what I experienced. And I just did it for me. It was just simply a journal. And I wrote this 60,000-word journal from this trip, and I documented it with what turned out to be beautiful photographs. And then, you know, when I got home, just life takes over and you forget about that, and it goes in a box and up in the attic. And it stayed there for 40 years until COVID. And then I got the book out and I opened it for the first time in decades, literally. And it was like an anthropological dig into a 23-year-old version of myself. What a trip. And it was pretty vividly written. It was very unguarded, very candid, not very politically correct, and just a delightful chapter in my life that really laid the groundwork for what I've done ever since.
Yeah, you know, it reminded me of my own travel journal when I was in 23, because I took a very important road trip. It was around North America by van. It's what they call van life now. And I've always said that I'll never be able to travel like a 23-year-old again, because you only have that first journey is pretty unique. And it's interesting, so you are geographically different, but there's something about being that age and just being excited about everything. And, you know, Rick, something that stood out is how much melon you ate over the course of your trip through Asia. It
did
just
that,
feels
did
like
that
young
come across?
23-year-old
yeah.
Rick loved melon.
No, it was I could eat it with no nervousness about, is it good for my health? Mm. It was like a solid liquid I could drink. And a luxury for us was going into a tea house, and you'd pay 25 cents for a pot of tea, and you'd had a honeydew melon, and you'd ask them to cut it up, and they would cube it for you and bring it to you on a big stainless steel platter. And you could just sit there and sip your tea and eat this melon on a backpacker's budget. And it just felt really luxurious for me to be able to do that. And so that was one of my little special little pleasures along the road, when for much of the time we were sick. I mean, people on the hippie road, the joke was there's two kinds of travelers on the hippie road, people who know they have worms and people who don't know they have worms.
Yeah, no, that stood out. And I guess that makes sense, you know, that if you cut it open, it's less likely to be infected with something.
Right.
But it just seems so much more romantic. In my first trip traveling around North America by van, Taco Bell was my go-to. So.
Oh, yeah. No, there's no Taco Bells on the hippie trail.
Yeah.
But, you know, the interesting thing, Rolf, is, you know, some people say, oh, you can't do that anymore. Well, no, you can't do exactly 1978 from Istanbul to Kathmandu. But you can have your own hippie trail today. Hmm. Men, women, you can have it if you have that right wanderlust, that travel with abandon, that ability to embrace serendipity and run with it, and understanding that you learn more about your home by leaving it and looking at it from a distance, and that culture shock is a good thing. It's constructive. It's the growing pains of a broadening perspective. And, you know, these days I like to think it should be curated. And I like to think that's what I do as a travel writer, is I help people have culture shock in Europe, and I help curate it so it becomes constructive and a good thing.
Yeah, well, I like the mix of sort of excitement and happiness with a little bit of homesickness and frustration that came through in the journal, maybe in the way only a 23-year-old journal can. And I want to dig into that in a second, but I want to talk first about your preparation for the trip, because, you know, I traveled Asia on Lonely Planet Guides, and Lonely Planet Guides also came out of the hippie trail in the 1970s. And that was pre-internet. Now, I imagine young people can hardly imagine traveling without the internet, but you were traveling before there was much guidebook documentation to that part of the world. So how did you get into the mindset of traveling from Istanbul to Kathmandu?
You know, I'm a big fan of Lonely Planet. Anytime I go somewhere outside of Europe, I use a Lonely Planet guidebook. And I don't remember using a Lonely Planet guidebook on this trip. I'm not sure why. I think their guidebook to Southeast Asia was out. I think maybe their India guidebook was out by 78, but they were the standard book. I remember on later trips to India, just thinking every traveler, whatever language they speak, has that Lonely Planet English language guide to India. And I thought, that's what I want to do. I want to cover Europe and cover it with the same sort of success that they did India. And I think we have. But for this trip, it was an information desert. When I was on a 10-hour bus heading east in Iran or Afghanistan or Turkey, I went up and down the aisle of the bus, made friends with any traveler, and if they had any information, I would borrow it and read it during that ride. Aussies had their own information. Brits had their own information. The Germans and the French had their information, and Americans had a little information. But it was pretty haphazard. And as I prepared for the trip, I went to a class, I remember, in Seattle. At the University of Washington, they had this free college where people could teach dancing and bike repair and travel. And this guy had done the hippie trail, and he had a class. So I signed up for the class. Perfect. I'm going to learn from this guy. It was such a bad class. He just didn't care about us. He didn't get organized. It was a total lost opportunity. And I remember being not offended by it, but I just kept thinking, this is wrong. You've got the information. You had 20 kids in your class that were going to do this. You could have helped us, but he just didn't give a hoot. And I think that stuck with me, because I've taken that appreciation of the value of hard-earned firsthand experience turned into helpful, well-designed travel information so other first-timers can learn from somebody else's experience rather than their own have a better trip. That's kind of what powers me in my work, because when I went home from this trip, the last words in the book are something like, I flew home and gave up my piano students and started a small travel business. That was the change in my life. I had a recital hall where my piano students would give their concerts, and I turned it into a lecture hall. And I started filling it with people who were going to Europe, and I'd give them talks about that. And the value of that information became very clear to me when I did the hippie trail without information.
And just as an aside about that, you did that stuff for free, right? That you didn't really charge admission, that you sort of created the Rick Steves brand by being the guy who would just talk about travel.
Well, I in the very beginning, I charged $8 for the 8-week series. And I found that some people, one person out of a traveling couple was going to go because they didn't have $8 for both of them. And I said, oh, that's crazy. Both of you come. And then later on, when I self-published my first edition of Europe Through the Back Door, I started just giving my talks for free and hoped that people would buy the book and I'd make enough money to make it worthwhile from that. And that philosophy is the same today. I don't charge for my TV show, for example. I just give it to public television. And, we do good business. We take 30,000 people on our bus tours around Europe every year. But I'll go any place and give a talk for a public television station or something. And my reward is just to be able to share this information and, create a few fans, and they'll buy my books or take my tours.
Yeah, it's funny you're talking about sharing information sort of on the hippie trail bus level. The Australians have some information and the Brits have other information. I think that's such a strange technological moment when you can actually get a data plan, probably, when you're going across Iran right now. And one funny detail about you, your trip, is that you rationed yourself to 9 photos a day. Can you talk a little bit about your photographic approach?
Well, this is something people don't remember, but now we just shoot pictures like they're free, because they kind of are. But back then, you had to have your film, of course. And if you're going on a big, long trip and you can't restock, you take what you can take from home. The big decision was, do you have 36 frames or 20 frames in a canister? I would always have 36, because it would be almost half as much room in my backpack taken up for 360 photographs. That'd be 10 canisters. And I had 8 or 9 or 10 shots a day was my ration, because that's all the film I had. And the other thing was, you didn't know how it was turning out until you got home, and then you sent it. You send it to Kodak, and you'd get your slides back, and then you just hope and pray that they were good. And these were good.
They were. I was impressed both by the quality of the prose in your journal and by the photographs, too. I mean, you even had a selfie. You had pointed a picture in a mirror, and there's a picture of a selfie picture of you back before that was a word.
You know, Al Gore may have invented the internet, but I invented the selfie.
Excellent. No, there's proof of it in your new book. What did you expect when you first set out? Well, actually, while we're on the topic of technology, one funny detail about your journal is that your friend... You were going to meet your friend in an airport, and he didn't show up. And so then you had to fall back on a backup plan. So I think part of this conversation is just going to be about how the technological moment was different. You couldn't just text your friend and say, where are you?
This is a big deal. I remember in my very early days of teaching Europe, back when my company was called Europe Through the Back Door, it was a big deal. How do you connect with people in Europe? You hang out at the American Express office all day long until they show up. You know, I mean, it was hard to know where people were. How did loved ones keep track of where their children were and so on? Now, obviously, you got the trackers. I mean, you know where everybody is at all times. But back then, if you didn't connect for some reason, you might like be two ships that missed each other in the night or whatever, and you never see each other again. When I read about that journal, I had forgotten about that. You know, it was 40 years ago. But yeah, we had a backup plan, and I was pretty glum, you know, like defeated, leaving the airport without my travel partner and going, well, I'll go to the train station, like we said, and lucky track 13, maybe he's there. And there he was. And then we set off, and that was in Frankfurt. And then we headed east. And I remember when it was an adventure right from the start. It was so exciting. And when we left Istanbul, I remember it occurred to me, we're heading east from Istanbul. If you kept going long enough, you'd get to Seattle, where we lived. And I thought, there's not a single soul between here and Seattle that knows I even exist. And I don't know a single soul between here and Seattle. And that's where we're going. All of our money's in traveler's checks in our money belts. There's no great information. We have no reservations. I'm assuming I can go to what was called a bucket shop in Delhi or and buy a ticket back to Europe, where my flight would take me home. But I didn't know for sure. And we were green. We were naive. It was like swimming in a pool of sharks. We were rich compared to local people, and a lot of people would have no qualms about ripping us off. I hope they wouldn't knife us, but they could rip us off. This was quite an adventure. And we carbonated it by smoking marijuana, which really made things a lot more colorful.
Right. Well, that was your first marijuana experience. And I want to talk about that and other small pleasures that you found along the way. But first, what were your expectations as you headed east from Istanbul? Because I would imagine in that pre-internet age, maybe you'd heard about the Beatles in Rishikesh, or you'd heard about people climbing Mount Everest, or you'd read some Rudyard Kipling or something. So you and your friend, what did you expect to find?
Yeah, my favorite movie back then was The Man Who Would Be King. And it's a Rudyard Kipling story about the Hindu Kush. And I expected we'd find these, you know, amazing tribal communities up in the Himalayan mountains and so on. And we really did find that. Everything was new. Everything was different. You'd be in the shadow of Mount Ararat, where Noah's Ark docked, and you'd be in a little village, and the sun's going down, and you'd have this cacophony of song as all the minarets were calling the call to prayer. You'd come into Tehran, and you'd go into the markets, and you'd see these rickety framed photographs of the Shah, and just get a sense that these are about to crash to the ground as the dictator was about to be thrown out of power and the theocracy was going to be founded. You crossed into the scary border crossing between Iran and Afghanistan was just epic, and you'd stay there and you wouldn't know how many hurdles you got to go through in order to get into Afghanistan where you could carry on to Kabul. But I'll never forget, we didn't have a guidebook, but we had a big, long map. We'd unfold it. And between where we were and Kathmandu, we measured by how many border crossings were in front of us. And because at each border crossing, you know, you had to get somebody that looked at your yellow international certificate of vaccination and make sure you had the right shots. Gene, my partner, did not have the right shot at the border of Afghanistan. So we had to wait over here. And then finally, the doctor comes. I'll never forget looking at my buddy while they took out the well-worn needle, and the needle literally bent as they forced it into his arm to give him that shot.
Goodness.
And I just thought, oh, geez, I'm glad my certificate of vaccination is properly filled out. And then you change money, and there's all these stories going around that you don't know what color the new currency is, and you know, con artists will sell stupid tourists money that was out of circulation and no longer of any value. And you didn't know what was right. So you just kind of changed some money and you hoped it worked. And you'd be in a dirt floor hotel for an override on your multi-day bus ride across Turkey. And the police would throw a packet of cigarettes on the floor and kind of say, whose are these? And nobody would claim them because they were full of marijuana, and then they could frame you. And they wouldn't throw you in jail, but they'd get a lot of money out of you so you didn't go to jail. This was just kind of, you know, the adventure of being on the hippie trail. And then you met wonderful people, and you went to wonderful markets and wonderful festivals and wonderful canoe rides and wonderful horse rides and wonderful elephant rides, and everything was just a trip. Even before it was actually a trip.
Right. Right. Well, I want to get onto your first hash experience in a second, but I know that there's a funny entry in Afghanistan where you sort of missed Seattle. So you had all this excitement going on, but what were some of the low points? What were some of the things you had to overcome and the difficulties as you went across there? Or is that?
Because we're talking about the journal I wrote for myself. Mm-hmm. When I was 23 years old. That's what this book is. It is the journal. It's a little bit redesigned for smooth flow and a few less descriptions of diarrhea and a few less log kind of things. Like today we had breakfast and then we caught the bus. But it is the unvarnished journal. And when I read through it, it occurs to me, Gene was sick a lot. And it also occurs to me, we were questioning whether this is a good idea. And every day we got that much farther away from backpacker heaven on a Greek island, you know, where all the kids were and all the cute girls were. And we were sitting here, you know, struggling our way ever further east, farther away from Europe where we were comfortable. And, it occurred to us, you know, we could always turn around and go to Greece and have a vacation. But we kept going, and I'm so glad we did. And then when we finally got to India, it was like coming home. And that was just, it was such a fascinating experience to be going where you didn't know you were going to be and what it was going to be like. And it's like, it's really travel with abandon. I just loved it.
I'm curious how the spiritual aspect of travel manifested itself. You said before that travel can be a school, a playground, or a church. And I think you and I both have Lutheran backgrounds. Are you LCMS or ELCA?
ELCA.
Okay, so you're a Scandinavian Lutheran. I grew up a German Lutheran, LCMS. My listeners are probably shrugging and saying, what on earth are you thinking about?
Well, any Lutheran knows that. There's two Lutheran churches. Well, there's several Lutheran denominations. And I think the biggest one is the ELCA. That's more progressive. And then people who aren't comfortable with women pastors and gay people sitting next to you at church, they would be in the other more conservative Lutheran churches. But I'm proud of how progressive the ELCA Lutheran church is.
Well, Rick, I was LCMS, which is very conservative, but my pastor was a missionary. He served missions in Taiwan, and he was just very cerebral. And I think because he was global, I think when you grow up, this is sort of an aside, but when you grow up that way, the first international people you meet in a place like Kansas are the missionaries who come back from Ghana or Bolivia, and they're telling you about the other side of the world. And for people without a lot of passports in their social group, that can be some of your first glimpses into other parts of the world.
Very true.
But spiritually, I mean, you traveled through Muslim lands, which may have been a first for you, and Hindu lands. How did, keeping in mind that people express their spirituality in different cultural ways, what was the spiritual texture of the trip for you? Because for me, oftentimes I found that when I was sick, I was sort of raised to a more spiritual level because I wasn't able to fall back on comforts, conveniences, and consumer niceties, that I was sort of forced to deal with hardship, and that yielded spiritual reward. So I'm curious to know what the spiritual aspect of your hippie trail experience was.
It is interesting. Yeah. As a 23-year-old, when I look at it and I read the book and I can, it comes across, I was charmed by other holy places and religions. I love the sound of the call to prayer. I love going into a mosque. And Hinduism is very exotic to me. It's not monotheistic, but I found a grace in it. Fundamentally, when I travel, I'm tuned into the fact that we're all, if you believe in God, regardless of how you, you know, what religion you approach God with, if you believe in God, then you know that we have a heavenly Father, a creator. And that means we're all children of that God. And with that, logically, we're all brothers and sisters. And in my faith, it's all about love your neighbor. But when you travel and incorporate your faith with a traveler's perspective, you realize that love your neighbor has nothing to do with proximity. Somebody across the street, somebody across the sea, in God's eyes, and through the eyes, I think, of a person of faith who believes in God, we are all brothers and sisters. And that also means love and suffering and need is just as real across the sea as it is across the street. And when you travel, you humanize the planet and you get that sense of oneness. And that, to me, is one of the great takeaways of travel. And I just love it. When I travel, I feel close to God. When I travel, I love to see the love between a parent and that parent's child, a parent who's so distant from my reality back in Seattle, and to see the oneness of that. It's a beautiful thing, and I take that home with me. To me, we've talked about this before, Rolf, I think I like the thought that, you know, there's tourists, there's travelers, and there's pilgrims. And it's not enough travelers are giving themselves the opportunity to be spiritual on the road, or be poetic on the road, to be philosophical on the road. So I like to be a fun-loving tourist. I just like to have a good time on the beach. I like to be a traveler doing new things and enjoying, you know, all this fun new food and so on. And I like to be a pilgrim, learning about what life's all about far away from home. And people that don't consider mixing that all together, I think, are missing an opportunity to enrich their travels and let their travels be transformational. If you travel halfway around the world and come back and aren't changed, you're a tourist. I think it's important to be a little more than that if you want to get the most out of your travels.
I like the idea that travel expands the size of your neighborhood, that neighbors could apply to anyone. I think we live in an age where we don't consider other communities in our own cities to be our neighbors, right? You know that.
Oh, yeah. And it's speaking itself out in the news right now in our country. When you think about the initiative to make our country great, what does that really mean, to make our country great? What is the need for education, the need to survive a changing climate, is the need for healthcare any less valuable south of the border? I'm an economic person. I like to get bang for my buck. And if everybody is equally precious in God's eyes, what's wrong with a little bit of assistance to people where, I mean, this is kind of wonky, but where $10,000 will buy a beautiful community center? I've just been a primary funder and a real proponent of a $20 million community center we've built here in my little town. And it's a good investment, $20 million, and our city has a senior center and a wonderful place where people can gather. But for $10,000, I mean, that's almost nothing compared to what we spend for ours. The same kind of a community can get the same kind of value south of the border, Guatemala or something like that. I just love that. It just turns me on to no end. And, Thomas Jefferson said, travel makes a person wiser, if less happy. And I think about that a lot. The exposure makes you more clued in to what really matters. And then the challenge and the frustration of making the world a better place might make you a little less happy. I'm thankful that I'm in that camp. And I love the idea that Muhammad 1600 years ago said, don't tell me how educated you are. Tell me how much you've traveled.
I'm curious, oftentimes in your journal, you noted how content poor people were. And so I'm curious to know, you found yourself rich by accident by traveling in poorer parts of the world, but it feels like you also discovered that the poor people were not frustrated in the same way that middle-class Americans can be by certain perceived shortcomings in life. So what was your, how was your attitude towards wealth transformed by this journey?
This is the first, when I think back on it, you know, when you're a kid traveling, you're just looking for a beer and a bunch of girls and, you know, thrills, which is fine. It's fun. But when I was traveling on this trip, it's the first time I started being made aware of other more important things. And I remember in Tehran, looking at homeless people leaning up against a big, shiny international bank building. And that was a pretty brutal visual of the gap between rich and powerful and poor and powerless. And then, of course, in India, you've got castes that are designed to be beggars, and their parents intentionally mutilate them so they can be more effective beggars on the streets. And every time a train stops, you know, the beggars come onto the train and they scoot down the aisle, pushing their tin can that you put money in and designed to pull on people's heartstrings. It's pretty powerful. And then you realize what the needs are of somebody who's privileged and from the richest part of the world. And it just stimulates you. And it makes you more clued into the realities. And it made me more tuned into the structural foundation of poverty and hunger on this planet. There's more than enough food produced in virtually every country for that country to feed its own people. It's just a matter of distribution and who's got the money. And I've been struggling with this ever since. I'm fascinated by it. I'm a longtime supporter of Bread for the World, which gives hungry people a voice in the halls of Congress so that our budgets can deal compassionately and effectively with hunger issues. I even studied and scouted and wrote a script and produced a one-hour TV special called Hunger and Hope, Lessons Learned in Ethiopia and Guatemala, which I love this show, and I was able to produce it just on the eve of COVID. And it's a very good look at why there's hunger in a world with so much affluence, so many billionaires. But this, all the seeds for this concern, I think, Rolf, were planted when I was on the hippie trail, because I got to see it. And also I got to learn this idea of a diminishing curve of returns for the more that we consume. You know, if you don't have much and you got an extra $1,000, that's really important. But the more you have, the less that extra $1,000 matters. And you do reach a point where it levels off, and consuming another $1,000 does not make you happier. Mm. And an enlightened consumer knows when that has leveled off, and they don't continue consuming just because they've got the money, but they find ways to vicariously consume it by philanthropically investing it in somebody else who's still steep on that curve of diminishing benefits for further consumption. I just like looking at it as an economist, and it just makes a lot of sense, and it makes me happier.
Well, that's an interesting lesson of travel, is just sort of being forced to confront poverty in a way that's uncomfortable. Like maybe we know that there's poverty in our own hometowns, but we don't go to that part of our hometown. And so in a second, I want to get to the sort of the lessons learned, because it feels like this Asia through the back door was sort of informed with some wisdom that probably came out of that journey. But first, I've already talked about your hash experience. I don't want to leave the listeners hanging. This is your first hash experience. What did you expect? How was it? And how did you come out the other side from your first drug experience on the hippie trail?
It's kind of like somebody who's nervous about losing their virginity. You know, I had never smoked marijuana before. I had made a point. I don't want to smoke it just because all the kids are smoking it at school. I didn't want to have the peer pressure to make me have my first experience getting high. I wanted to do it when it felt right, when it felt culturally correct. And it felt culturally correct on the hippie trail. Afghanistan, India, Nepal, great places to smoke pot. And so I talked it over with Gene, who was more experienced than me, and we bought some marijuana or hash. And to be honest, I wasn't even clear which is which, but it's all the same as far as I'm concerned. You smoke it and you get high. And we did it in Herat, the first city in Afghanistan. It was great. And then when I read the journal, it's so fun to look at how we stumbled onto that and how how tentative I was about it. And then I'm reading what I wrote after that, and I'm not sure if I was high or not when I write it. It sounds like I could have been high because everything was so thrilling. I mean, chariots were charging through the dark with their torches on, you know.
Wow.
It was really to have that experience. Whoa. Later on, we were in a jungle, you know, and leeches were coming at us, these demonic little black slinkies, head over tail, doggedly coming at us. We'd step back and they'd continue coming at us, wanting to suck our blood. Was I high and paranoid, or was that actually a thing, you know? I'm not sure. But you don't need to be high to enjoy Afghanistan and India and Nepal that way. But it added to the experience, that's for sure. So we did it. We'd walk around. Other people were smoking pot. The whole world was glassy-eyed over there. And it was the way we did it, it was really joyful. Some of the happiest moments in my life were on that trip, doing amazing things that felt even more amazing because we had smoked a little marijuana. And of course, the end of the road, Kathmandu, that was where the rainbow kind of lands. And that rainbow landed in Freak Street in Kathmandu. And there you have a little coffee shop called Pie and Chai.
Right,
and
yeah.
Pie and Chai is where all the hippies met. And you're listening to great, great classic rock and roll, The Doors and Creedence and The Stones. And you've got this medieval style pizza oven that's cranking out fresh apple pie and all sorts of different pies. And you're already high altitude wise. And you're surrounded by Himalayan peaks. And you're listening to the music. You're surrounded by cool hippies from all over the world. Philosophers, poets, musicians, great travelers, incredible people. And you've got this apple pie. You've got monkeys hanging out in the branches above you, ready to swoop down and steal your glasses because they like things that are shiny. And you're writing in your journal, and you're at the end of the hippie trail, and you realize half of the kids around you, they've checked out, they're staying here, forever. They're no longer homesick because this is their home, and their hair is matted into dreadlocks. And I was going back home to work because I was not really that much of a, I was a round trip hippie. I had a flight to, I was heading home. But that was all part of growing up. It's a coming of age trip, and it gave me an appreciation for the joy of traveling with a little help of marijuana. You know, I've done a lot to help legalize the responsible adult use of marijuana in our country as a civil liberty, not because I'm pro-drugs, but because I think it's a civil liberty. And people ask me why, I'm a travel writer, and for me, high is a place. Sometimes I want to go there. It's just as a matter of principle, high is a place. There are times my government can say I can't go somewhere, and I can understand that, and I'll go with that. But there's got to be an honest reason. And there's no honest reason that a responsible adult in the privacy of their own home can't enjoy a little marijuana if they want to. That's another interview. But then, you know, that was sort of started, that whole understanding or sensibility about that started for me in Afghanistan and India and Nepal.
Curious to know what you learned. It can include pot and hash if you want, but it can include almost anything. What lessons you brought home? Because I know one line that stood out to me in your journal is that a good experience combines good sleep, good food, and a good hotel. But then also I know that Asia Through the Back Door was influential on me when I was a young traveler in the 90s. And that really preached the sermon of spending less money to have better experiences, going slow when you could go fast. And it feels like there's a connection between Asia Through the Back Door and your new journal on the hippie trail. So I'm curious to know what was transformed in your thinking, and what lessons did you bring home from this adventure?
Well, at the time, I brought home lessons just like you said, you know, enjoy the moment. When serendipity knocks, go for it. Over time, and now if I look back at it, the takeaway is this is a valuable opportunity for somebody as they're growing up, especially younger people, to have that opportunity to get away from home and challenge the sensibilities your parents have given you. You know, parents love their kids, but sometimes that love comes with a heavy burden of being just like your parents. And a lot of people never break away from that culturally. And if you have a chance to travel, you've got a chance to reassess things, and you've got a chance to hang out with people who find different truths to be self-evident and God-given. And to me, this is a very honest reassessment that a thoughtful person might want to have before they settle into their groove, because we, most of us, settle into a groove after that, and it says who we are. And I'm thankful that I had this travel experience to help me settle into a groove that makes me a person with a global perspective, a person who's not afraid of diversity, but who celebrates diversity. A great takeaway for me is I live in a country that is 4% of this planet. And the only thing exceptional about us in God's eyes is our ability to think that we are exceptional. We're not. We're fine. But so are the Norwegians, and so are the Sri Lankans, and so are the Japanese. And if we get to know each other, it makes it tougher for their propaganda to dehumanize us. And when we come home, it makes it tougher for our propaganda to dehumanize them. And we're a force for peace. You know, the United States, right now, there's two kinds of people. There's people who are riddled with fear, that have no passport, whose worldview is shaped by TV, commercial TV news. And that's all by design. Because when that's your worldview, you're a frightened person, and you can be manipulated by wannabe autocrats, whether they're left-wing or right-wing, make you afraid of the world, and all you want to do is build walls. But somebody who's traveled, we're not afraid. People who have traveled understand that the world is filled with joy, it's filled with love, it's filled with good people. Of course, there's complicated issues and bad characters, but generally the world's a good place. It's a safe place, it's a friendly place. And the irony is, the people who are so afraid about being safe, they want to build walls. And that's the wrong thing to build if you want to be safe. If you want to be safe, you need bridges. Hmm. And the United States needs to be at the table when the world is dealing with complicated issues. Because the challenges of the future are going to be impervious to our walls, whether they're physical or metaphorical. Hmm. Those challenges will just, you know, flood right over them. In the future, the challenges confronting us, I think, will need good governance, an embrace of science, an appreciation of the fragility of nature, and a realization that we got to grapple with these problems as a family of nations. And if the United States is going to pull out of the family of nations and hide behind walls, because we want to be richer, we want to be more safe, we want to be great again. It's a sad irony, because it's going to make us small, and it's going to make us ultimately less safe. We need to stop looking at our quarterly profit statements and start looking at a long-term approach to the world and a realization that America, that the world needs us. The ideals of America still inspire, not the ideals of our current administration, the ideals of America. Those are the shining, inspirational essence of what our country is all about. And if we're not at the table, the world misses us. Great things are less likely to happen because the United States gives it a critical mass and some horsepower and an oomph that is not there otherwise. So that's my takeaway from travel. That's in a macro sense. In a micro sense, my takeaway is 2025, anybody with a curiosity and a wanderlust can have their own hippie trail. They don't need to go from Istanbul to Kathmandu, and they don't need to smoke marijuana. They just need to get away from home and embrace the world and have an adventure and go home with a beautiful souvenir. And that's a dual citizenship, a better appreciation of what it's like to be an American, and the luxury, the beauty of a global citizenship, because we're all in this together.
This has been Deviate with Rolf Potts. More about everything that was just mentioned, including the new Rick Steves travel memoir On the Hippie Trail, can be found in the show notes at rolfpotts.com/deviate. And as always, you can contact me with insights or questions at deviate@rolfpotts.com. This episode was produced by Cedar Van Tassel, who also does the theme music. Thanks for listening, and I hope you tune in for future episodes of Deviate with Rolf Potts.